And we will move on to the second case for this morning, WellPoint Health against John Hancock Life, number 082283. Mr. Shallot?
Good morning, Your Honor. On behalf of Appellant John Hancock, parties to an arbitration agreement consent to be bound and are bound only by awards rendered by arbitrators selected in the manner contained in the party's agreement. Here, one member of the disputed panel was selected in a manner not set forth in the arbitration agreement. The disputed panel thus had no authority to bind the parties.
Now, you argued this throughout your brief, Mr. Shallard, but there's a real characterization issue here because arbitration agreements are frequently silent about all manner of procedural questions. And the arbitral panel in this case was initially formed exactly in accordance with the agreement. Everybody agrees with that. And then we have the circumstance of Mr. Nichols' resignation. And at that point, one could say there's a gap, and the party arbitrator nominated by Hancock, Mr. DiCarlo, and the umpire settle on a procedure for something about which the agreement was silent, namely selecting the WellPoint arbitrator. They follow that procedure. It's certainly nothing like the original procedure. Hancock didn't have the right to specify three people that WellPoint could choose. So they devise a procedure. It seems to me arbitrators are in charge of all interim procedures once the arbitration is up and going.
Judge Wood, we believe that the issue of arbitrator selection is very different from the other types of procedural other issues.
Why? Why is arbitrator replacement, which I want to call it, instead of selection, different from anything else that might happen?
Because it goes to the fundamental issue of whether the parties have consented to let this person decide the issue and thereby to give authority to this arbitrator.
But they consented to Mr. DiCarlo and Mr. Baca deciding, and they actually also consented to decisions of two of the arbitrators, in 15.3, making decisions.
Actually, Judge Wood, I think that's wrong. What 15.3 says is that a panel of three arbitrators has to make decisions. They can make decisions by majority rule.
Well, it actually mentions two arbitrators in 15.3.
It says two of the three, but the 15.3 says that decisions have to be made by a panel of three arbitrators. The fact that you can have a majority decision doesn't remove the requirement of three arbitrators. That's very much like the 11th Circuit case. It's identical in that respect, Your Honor.
So why is it that the decision of the three arbitrators to allow Mr. DiCarlo and Mr. Baca to construct a replacement scenario not binding?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, as the district court found, it was unclear that there was any such decision. There certainly wasn't a decision as to whether the contract permitted this, whether this matter of selection of replacement was consistent with the arbitration agreement. In fact, what WellPoint had told the panel was that it would be, and by their own admission, impracticable for Mr. Nichols to continue, and he resigned. So it's not clear that there's any decision, and there couldn't have been a decision.
I don't know about that. I mean, we have action, and of course, once you've opted for arbitration to begin with, you have opted out of the kind of transparency that the courts will give you. People think that arbitration is efficient for that reason. You don't have to have opinions for everything. You don't have to have open and public proceedings. You don't have to have lots of things. So why isn't the mere fact that this is what happened a good sign that that's what the arbitrators decided to do? That's what Mr. DiCarlo and Mr. Baca said.
Because if the issue is whether the arbitrator was selected in accordance with the party's agreement, and if the answer to that question is no, the consent that is the cornerstone of arbitration doesn't exist, and the arbitrator has no authority at all. And that's a question not for the arbitrators, but for a court, precisely because, as this court said in International Machinists, and as the district court found, arbitrators are not the judge of their own authority.
Well, sometimes they are and sometimes they aren't. You do cite First Kaplan, but First Options against Kaplan. But let me ask you a different question. And this has to do with the difference between Section 5 and Section 10 of the Federal Arbitration Act. It is inconceivable to me that you would be here if the ultimate award had been $464.6 million and that had been the award that the panel that Justice Krushova had come up with. And there's a bit of tension. I'm not going to go so far as to say that there's some absolute legal obligation to use Section 5 procedures, But it does seem to me that the standard of review, perhaps, should be much more unwilling to upset an arbitration agreement if you wait all the way to the Section 10 stage, and that we should be looking more the same way we do even with jury verdicts, and that unless there's some sign of bias or impropriety in the panel that actually sat, we should let the arbitration award stand.
Well, bias, of course, is a separate ground for vacating under the statute.
There is no ground, by the way. I mean, you can read Section 10 all day, and it's not going to say if the arbitrators are selected in accordance with the procedure not spelled out in the agreement, the award can be set aside. You are relying on much more general language in Section 10.
Well, but that's because six courts of appeal, including this court, have said that the arbitrators did not have authority. And so it's an absence of authority, which is the statutory ground. Judge, well, let me come back to your question about why this issue is different. There are many issues, sort of classic issues of arbitrability, that are not for an arbitrator to decide, but rather for a court to decide.
Well, that's true.
Even though those are issues that involve an issue of contract interpretation, for instance, whether a dispute on the merits is within the scope of an arbitration clause, we would submit that arbitral selection is logically antecedent to those questions. This is a question.
According to your view, though, you could, in fact, according to your view, if an arbitrator dropped dead, you would still have to just cancel everything and start all over again.
That's not, no, Your Honor, that's not my view.
But that's not specified in the agreement.
It's not. What could have happened under this agreement, why that's different, Your Honor, is we could have then consented, and if we had consented to proceed with the replacement, and we might have viewed it differently.
Suppose you didn't like the panel, though, and you decide not to consent. The arbitrator drops dead, you have to start all over again.
If the arbitration agreement, drafted here by sophisticated parties advised by counsel, does not provide for that contingency, then yes, Your Honor, that's the result. In fact, that's the general rule. But my point
is that
we might well have viewed that situation differently, and there may well be other situations where the parties would then consent, and consent would provide what's missing here.
That's the thing. If you're saying only when you consent, then all of the strategic possibilities, you know, maybe you decide you don't like Mr. DiCarlo, for that matter. You appointed him as your party arbitrator, but you're thinking, boy, this guy's really not working out. Oh, isn't this lucky the arbitrator dropped dead? You know, so now we get to start all over again.
Well, Your Honor, with all respect, the gamesmanship started here not through anything that John Hancock did. It was with an arbitration panel in place engaging in deliberate gamesmanship.
We don't know if it's gamesmanship or not. We have to take this record as it comes to us, where we really flat do not know why Mr. Nichols chose to resign. We don't know if it was the most compelling of reasons, if it was the most frivolous of reasons, if it was the most strategic of reasons. I think we just don't know.
Well, WellPoint in its brief says that the reason that their attitude changed was that the dimensions of the case had grown significantly from the initial demand. That is precisely the sort of reason that shouldn't be tolerated as a ground, because
they said that's why they changed lawyers, actually.
They also said that was what prompted them to reevaluate who was on the panel. The point is, this was a significant departure.
Mr. Nichols had some prior relationship with LaBeouf Lamb. I mean, you know, changing you're assuming this nefarious overtone, but no one, not the district court or anyone, has said that it's there.
Well, but, Your Honor, because the district court said it was consistent with the general intent of the parties that there only be that each side pick one. We think that there were serious, and certainly under the law of R.J. O'Brien and the other cases, non-trivial. I mean, recall that the non-trivial, Bolko is an example of a trivial departure. There, the parties had agreed that the arbitrator had to be an attorney. He was an attorney but not admitted to the bar. The court said that's a non-trivial. These are not non-trivial departures. First, the agreement said that the arbitrators had to be appointed within 20 days of the demand. We think it's illogical to read that as saying that that's an arbitrator pro tem or sort of a test drive arbitrator. And if you make that appointment timely, then you have a license to come to make multiple or one or more other subsequent appointments, perhaps years later.
There are other ways of reading that, though. I mean, having been involved a zillion years ago in some commercial arbitrations myself, those are provisions to get things rolling. You know, get the arbitrators in place, get the panel in place. Now you have a panel of arbitrators who can deal with both the discovery issues that you were working with unexpected procedural glitches, even a fundamental one like an arbitrator being unable to serve. get going with those 20-day rules.
But there's also the question of sequence. The sequence here was you appointed arbitrator before you knew who the umpire was. It's very different to know who the umpire is, and not only that, to get input from the umpire. That's a clear departure from the party's agreement. Certainly can't be viewed in our submission as a trivial departure. And in fact, what WellPoint achieved was, in effect, a do-over of its arbitral selection years into the proceeding, after there had been extensive proceedings, extensive interactions with the umpire, and a full airing of the merits. That's an unfair advantage. And
so why didn't Mr. DiCarlo object to the names on the list? He was your man.
Well, first of all, Your Honor, we made a clear objection as to Mr. Nichols' withdrawal, saying he shouldn't withdraw. We said if they did, it would interject. I mean, we preserved that issue, obviously, in spades.
I think you preserved that issue, too. I'm not
worried
about that.
Our view is that at that point, it doesn't matter what the panel thought or didn't think. It's not a decision for the panel to make. The panel is there to decide the merits. They're not there to decide who is supposed to decide the merits. That, in our submission, is a view for the court. It just it's even more so of an issue than other issues of arbitrability, because this is logically antecedent to the issue of whether a dispute is within the scope of a contract clause. This is a question about who is supposed to make this decision. We haven't consented.
If I may interrupt just for a minute, Mr. Schallert, it is antecedent, and maybe that's why it should have been taken care of earlier in the arbitration. I mean, I'm really concerned about whether you folks waived this thing. You sat there and let this thing go on. Section 5 gave you a remedy. You didn't take it. After the Dow Corning case in the Eighth Circuit, why isn't the game over? You live with it, Dow.
Well, first, we clearly stated this objection. We said that if he were withdrawn, it would introduce serious error. There was no waiver.
But the law gave you an immediate remedy.
Because the law also gives us a remedy after the proceeding is over. And this court has never held that a party has to go to court under Section 5.
But it's never had occasion to halt.
Well, but it certainly has had occasion to address what an appropriate step for a party to do is. In the Tamari case,
In terms of the underlying policy of the Federal Arbitration Act for quick, expeditious resolution of commercial activity, is it compatible to give you a remedy under Section 10 at the end of the litigation, as opposed to when the statute specifically gives you a remedy in Section 5 at the time of the supposed injury?
Yes, Your Honor. And let me tell you the reason for that. If we had gone to court under Section 5, that brings the whole proceeding to a halt, too. That's not efficient. And does this court...
But it means you wouldn't have had the whole hearing on the merits, wasting, apparently, Judge Khrushcheva's time, as well as that of Mr. DiCarlo and Mr. Baca. I mean, a lot happened after this substitution.
Yes, but we were already 3 years into the proceeding when this happened. So this wasn't... It wasn't as...
The existing record, you could have done a lot of things about that.
But... We didn't think that was the choice, because the Seventh Circuit had said, for instance, in Tamari, that you could come after an award and make that challenge to the arbitral authority. And there are two, as the district court, which rejected this idea that we had to go to court under Section 5, they rejected for a good reason. There are two alternative ways to address this under the statute.
As Judge Ripple's implying, there's definitely a heads I win, tails you lose, odor to this, where you would never have come and complained under Section 10 if you had gotten the type of damages you were looking for. So you get to sit off on the wayside, see how it goes. If it goes well, you do nothing. And if it goes badly, you come in and say, well, we have our Section 10 remedy.
Your Honor, there are all kinds of issues. If this court wants to encourage all sorts of, in effect, interlocutory appeals from arbitration, that's a very inefficient system, too.
This is the most important part of the whole arbitration, though. Couldn't you single out that and say other trivia doesn't come to the court now any more than it did yesterday, but this one is so central it should?
Well, it would have defeated there was a hearing scheduled. There are other reasons why it would have defeated the very efficiency of the process to invoke Section 5 at that point.
This doesn't defeat it even more?
Well, but Your Honor, as you say,
what do you know today about the process for choosing the missing arbitrator that you didn't know the day Mr. Nichols resigned?
Well, the only difference is now they say the reason is that the size of the award increased. But I agree. We knew at the time most of what we know today. But it shouldn't have been incumbent on us, and there's nothing in the law in this court's and most of the other circuits, although Dow is really an outlier in this regard, to suggest that we had to go to court back during the arbitration process, which is, again, a very inefficient and disruptive to the
efficiency. Why do you call Dow an outlier? Is other circuits to the contrary specifically on point?
Yes. I mean, we have explained in our brief why we think Dow is an outlier and why we think it's really
interesting. That's why I'm asking you. I really didn't catch that. I went back and reread that, as a matter of fact. I'm not too sure that I caught it.
Okay. Well, we think, for instance, it's at least inconsistent with what this court said in Tamari.
Tamari.
As an example.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Sarles.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Let me just make a short point on the Section 5 issue, which is, you know, the district court didn't agree with the Dow Corning ruling because Section 5 doesn't actually say that you have to go immediately or not. But that's true, but that's because it's silent. And I would just analogize to the judicial recusal statutes, which also don't say whether, if the judge refuses to recuse, whether you have to go to the Court of Appeals immediately or not. But this Court has held repeatedly that you do on a mandamus petition. And I think that same rationale should apply here. Well, Hancock's position...
Is there anything in the legislative history of Section 5 that would cast light on this?
No, there isn't, Your Honor. As you know, it was enacted in the 1920s. There is a fair amount of legislative history on the FAA, but I didn't see anything with regard to Section 5. Now, Hancock's position that a panel vacancy deprives the remaining arbitrators of any authority and requires the arbitration to start over is an argument that Hancock never made in the arbitration. To the contrary, it insisted that the schedule be maintained, that the arbitrators oversee the proceeding, that the arbitrators make a ruling on whether Mr. Nichols could resign or not. And when the arbitrators, including their own party arbitrator, accepted Mr. Nichols' resignation, Hancock said that the remaining arbitrators should appoint Nichols' replacement if Hancock itself couldn't. So in other words, Hancock not only waived this argument of no authority by not raising it in the arbitration, it affirmatively told the arbitrators, you do have the authority. We just don't like the conclusions you reach when you exercise it. But the fact that the arbitrators ruled other than as Hancock would have liked does not mean that they exceeded their authority.
So it's your opinion that if Mr. DiCarlo and Mr. Baca had just dictated that Justice Kroshova was going to be the replacement, that we wouldn't be here?
If they had simply dictated.
They just dictated, instead of a list of three that WellPoint chooses somebody from, they just said the third arbitrator is going to be Justice Kroshova.
Yeah, that would arguably conflict with the agreement, which the agreement doesn't expressly address replacements, as we know. But it does say that each party gets to choose an arbitrator, and it does say that the arbitrator has to have certain qualifications. And it also says that the arbitrators have the authority over the operation and interpretation of the agreement and should rule based on equity, fairness, and reason. And, you know, you could argue that, one, that's inconsistent with the agreement. You could also argue about whether it's consistent with reason or not. But I do think they have the authority to act as long as they at least consult the contract and attempt to comport with it. And here they went well beyond that. They established a deliberative, comprehensive process, and they took into account all the relevant facts and circumstances, including how it was that Nichols came to resign. Here's what the arbitrator said. They said, because the vacancy is not due to health, disability, or death, in other words, because it was you, WellPoint, that asked him to resign, the replacement could not be a unilateral decision by WellPoint. And that's at AA33 of the appendix. So, and they didn't let WellPoint unilaterally pick its replacement. They had hearings in which WellPoint's first two choices got dropped as a result. And then they had WellPoint choose from a short list that was proposed by Hancock's own party arbitrator. And remember, under these rules, the party arbitrator was not a neutral. It was an advocate up until the hearing. So they had the short list. WellPoint selected Judge Krivosha. The district court said Kroshova. It's actually Krivosha. But the arbitrators refused to accept Judge Krivosha until there had been a full hearing on him, in which Hancock's lawyers got full opportunity to voir dire him, and until Hancock said on the record that Judge Krivosha, who was a state Supreme Court justice and a former insurance company executive, you know, was contractually qualified. So the role of a reviewing court is not to say, gee, the arbitrator should have done X instead of Y, but simply to ascertain whether they exceeded their authority. And as the Eighth Circuit put it in Dow Corning, the question of how to fill a panel vacancy is a procedural issue for the arbitrators to decide. Now, Hancock says that has to be a panel of three and not two. You know, but when a vacancy arises in a panel of three, well, that necessarily requires action by the remaining two. And this court actually recognized that reality in one of the Tamari opinions. I think there are five. This is the third one, which is 619 F. 2nd at 1198, where there was an argument made that the award had to be vacated because one of the panel members had disqualified himself, and therefore the whole panel should have disqualified itself. And this court didn't accept that argument, which sort of refutes the so-called general rule that Hancock is advocating. Now, Hancock warns of gamesmanship, but the best protection against gamesmanship is the kind of comprehensive and deliberative process that the arbitrators implemented here when a vacancy arises. And actually, it's Hancock's rule that would promote gamesmanship because, as the Second Circuit recently pointed out in Zeiler, if the arbitration has to start over when a vacancy arises, that would enable bad faith manipulation of the arbitration process. And you can see why.
Yeah, I mean, there's sort of a broader question at issue here as well, which is what you do when an arbitration agreement doesn't specify a path for some unexpected event. And, of course, here it's the replacement arbitrator. And as I understand Hancock's argument, they draw the inference that silence equals you just have to go back to square one and start over again, whereas you're taking the position, no, silence equals the ability, at least in an arbitration agreement like this one, where the arbitrators have the right to interpret the contract and do all these things, that they get to devise a procedure along the way. I suppose if they had deadlocked, maybe that would have been a case to go back to the beginning, which they might have since there were just two of them. But what happens with silence? Should our presumption be that the arbitrators get to work it out, or should the assumption be that silence equals you go back to the beginning?
Yeah, I think the assumption should be that there's an implicit delegation to the arbitrators to address issues like this when they arise. As this court well knows from the many arbitration cases it's had before it, most arbitration clauses are very short. It would be very costly for the parties to try to foresee all the different issues that might come up. And so they implicitly delegate those issues to the arbitrators or leave them to later agreement by the parties. And clearly here the arbitrators had a lot of options at their disposal. If they thought that WellPoint had acted in bad faith, for example, they could have refused to accept the tender of Mr. Nichols' resignation, which would have put WellPoint in a very difficult position, but maybe it would have deserved it if it had acted in bad faith. That's assuming that Mr. Nichols would have accepted that request that he resigned to begin with if it was done in bad faith. For example, if there had been a partial summary judgment ruling against WellPoint, and the next day WellPoint gets up, unanimous, and the next day WellPoint gets up and asks Mr. Nichols to resign, that would be such obvious bad faith that the arbitrators may well go beyond what they did here. But they took into account what, in fact, they knew, and they had done quite a searching inquiry with lots of submissions by the parties, and they structured a process to address it, to minimize any prejudice to Hancock, and to get the arbitration moving to a final award, which was, the right thing to do given the circumstances of this lengthy arbitration. If there are no more questions, that's it. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Your time had run out, Mr. Shallard, but if you want 1 minute, I'll give it to you.
The Tamari decision is very distinguishable because there the agreement did not require a certain number of arbitrators to make a decision. Our view is that this is required a panel to make a decision, a full panel of three. What distinguishes this issue from the run-of-the-mill decision on the merits? This is not an issue about the merits. This is an issue about, as fundamental, as Chief Justice Rehnquist said, as fundamental as whether there's an existence of an agreement. It's as if there's an intermeddler or an imposter on a panel. That's not a decision for arbitrators to make. Arbitrators are not the judge of their own authority. And as a result, that's why this is different and why a court should satisfy itself before the marshals go out and attach assets. The court should have to satisfy itself that this was, in fact, something the parties consented to. And we never consented or delegated to that. In fact, the agreement suggests the otherwise. Finally, Your Honor, with respect to whether we were required to go to court under Section 5, again, that's never been, and I think the district court was correctly observed, that there are two different ways you can challenge us under the statute. This court had made clear in the past that there was a way to challenge it under Section 10. We shouldn't have to go to court under Section 5. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks to both parties. We will take the case under advisement.